You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Eleanor Roosevelt High School's new drama teacher chooses Aristophanes' Lysistrata for the school play, something happens to the women of Stellar Plains, New Jersey. This is the setting for Meg Wolitzer's new novel, The Uncoupling, where, under the influence of the ancient Greek play, the women in this quiet New Jersey suburb lose all interest in sexual intimacy. It's published by Penguin, and I'm very pleased that it brings Meg Wolitzer back to our show. Hi, Meg.
Hi.
So can you describe the Stellar Plains, New Jersey community you have created here?
Yeah, it's a regular high school filled with teachers and kids, and I kind of go into both worlds, the world of the teachers and the world of the kids. And it's an ordinary school year, and suddenly a wind blows through the bedrooms of these women, causing them all to turn away from men, grown women and teenagers who are sort of just starting love lives.
Now, should we assume that that breeze, that wind, is something that the Greek gods have sent?
Well, we shouldn't assume anything, I think, when we're reading a novel. But actually, yeah, I mean, I like doing something with the idea of Lysistrata, but it's not a contemporary version of Lysistrata. What it is really is I took the idea of the play because I realized that everything is a kind of spell. Falling in love is a spell. I mean, what else would make two people say, I must call you 100 times a day. I must be with you. I must send you little stuffed animals. Falling out of love is a kind of spell too. Why does that suddenly stop? And then literature is itself a spell. I mean, here's a play performed for the first time in 411 BC. Everybody knows it as the sex strike play. We all really know it. And I thought the power of literature is something that I want to really acknowledge in this book when I talk about the power of sex and desire.
Is Lysistrata really performed at many high schools?
No, it is a very bawdy, dirty play. I think that this is a progressive town, but they're doing a modified version, of course, because they're not doing arsenic and old lace.
So it's not any town, USA, but it is a sophisticated suburb of New York?
It's a New Jersey suburb. I personally grew up in Syosset, and we did a lot of applause and arsenic and old lace and mousetrap, I believe, things like that. But no, this is, you know, it exists in a kind of another world, a parallel universe to the suburbs that I know, where you could put it on, but it would be a little bit changed so that it wouldn't be so filthy, definitely.
Well, in Lysistrata, as you said, the women of Athens withhold sex as a way of pressuring the men to end the Peloponnesian Wars. In this case, nobody's trying to end the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq.
No, this is not an anti-war novel, although there is the background chatter of the depressing wars is definitely going on for these characters. But what happens?
Well, they mention Afghanistan a few times. One student even attempts to stage a protest withholding sex until the wars end. But I mean, the small town can have little impact on national politics.
No, I know. We all feel that we really don't have impact on things. And what happens, I think, in this book is that nobody knows that they're under a kind of spell, because I think none of us really does know that we're under the spells that we're under. And they suddenly just can't do it anymore. These women turn away. And it started for me really from hearing a bit of noise. You know, you marinate in an idea for a while when you're coming up with an idea for a novel. Women saying, I'm done with that, and think, what's that about?
Well, you had a piece in last Sunday's Times about something like that, a woman saying, I'd like to find somebody my husband can sleep with. That's how you begin it. And
everybody laughed in the room. The women laughed, yeah.
Well, and you made a point that I assume applies to your thinking on this book, that it's different for every individual.
Yeah, there are vicissitudes in everyone's life. I think that we live in this, you know, sex-saturated culture. And sort of since Freud, the idea that to be healthy is to be sexual, and therefore if you're not always sexual, you're kind of weaker. But that isn't true. I mean, there's lots of variations in libido, and there are ups and downs. It's quite seismic, I think.
But in your article, you talked about the fact that this applies to men as well as women. In your book, it really only applies to the women.
The novel really is looking at the women. And it's, for me, the question that I set for myself, because when I write a novel, I really kind of want to just explore a question, not necessarily answer it because that would be a polemic, but the question was, what happens to female desire over time? And I didn't want to make it about middle-aged women, a complaining book. It wasn't about, you know, my desires falling away. I didn't want it to be like the cover of a women's magazine. So I looked at the teenagers, and what would happen, I asked myself, that would make a teenage girl stop sleeping with the young man, you know, or boy she loved. And I thought, well, in the case, I wanted to do it through character, because I think what you remember of the books you love, you know, is character. Maybe she thought, oh, I realize it's not going to last past high school, and the sadness of that feeling.
Well, at the center of this book are a couple teach English, the Langs, and they have a pretty satisfying sex life until this happens. And then she feels disgust toward her husband, but she doesn't know why?
No, she has no idea why. Reader and the writer know why. But she just, you know, for her, Dory Lang, what happens is she and her husband are these wonderful teachers, the kind of cool teachers that kids like. She wears good boots that look like the kind of boots Chrissy Hynde would have worn. And she's nice, and their quizzes are seen as humane. So everybody knows that they sleep together still, and they like each other a lot. But one night in bed, toward the beginning of the book, this wind, this metaphorical wind, I'm not in deep Garcia Marquez territory of magic realism. That's not my shtick. This wind comes into her bedroom, and she realizes, oh, it's not the way it was when we were young. And the minute she has that thought, she can't undo it.
And Bev Cutler, the school's guidance counselor, bluntly tells her husband, our sex life is over. So, but how did they explain it to their husbands and their boyfriends?
They explain it in that kind of not quite articulated way that I think we all talk to each other sometimes. I mean, she says there's the sort of running joke in the book, really, because I hope the book is funny. There's a joke about saying to the husband, I've got that thing in the morning. Oh, what thing? You know, that thing, that meeting, as though she has to kind of prepare. She has to do sort of it's an Iron Man challenge that she has in the morning, so she can't make love with her husband the night before, which is absurd.
In one of your previous novels, The Position, the parents have written a bestseller called Pleasuring, One Couple's Journey to Fulfillment, which is a how-to book featuring illustrations of the couple in all various positions. Yeah. Was that another way of addressing how much of a minefield discussing sex can be?
Definitely. If this book had illustrations, it would be women sort of sitting, turned away, smoking, reading, doing things like knitting, doing things like that. You know, when you write about sex...
Or saying I'm tired.
Or saying I'm tired, or preparing for tomorrow's meeting furiously, I think that sex is a strange... is still, in this day and age, in this culture in which the imagery is everywhere, thoughts about sex, people speak openly about sex, it's still a peculiar thing that makes people very uncomfortable. I think people probably don't tell the truth about what happens. I have no idea of what goes on inside anyone else's relationship.
Because we're uncomfortable about the power of our desires, you think?
I think we really are. I think that being naked is being vulnerable. In The Position, I really wanted to talk about the awkwardnesses that happen between people. I mean, the juncture of sex and the family. Sex and the family don't go together. It's that fish and bicycle thing. And I thought, oh, that's a great way to sort of look at it. But in this case, desire does change, but there's a marriage, and marriages are not always a 30-year honeymoon.
Well, your book also deals with other things. You take a few digs at parents and their blind devotion to their kids. The letter from a parent to Dory Lang explaining that her son did pay attention in class despite referring to Harper Lee, the author of To Kill a Mockingbird, as Mr. Lee his essay.
Well, I definitely in this novel want to talk about the differences between the generation that grew up with books and the generation that grew up with books and technology. And there's a lot, I think, still to be said about that. Because on the one hand, you can feel like this Luddite and you can say, oh, kids today, they don't read the way we did when we walked 20 miles to school in the snow. But I think it's more complicated than that. You know, I grew up with books as what I considered hot objects. I used to go to the public library with my family. First, we'd go to Baskin-Robbins. Then we'd go to the library. And because my mother is a writer, they would let us take out extra books like she was a celebrity. And I would just take home a dozen books and want to lose myself in the spell of those books. It's a little different now.
Your mother's Hilma Wallitzer, well-known writer. Was she a role model for you?
Oh.
Some kids don't want to do anything like what their parents do, and others want to go into the same profession.
There was an essay by, I think maybe it was Jonathan Lethem, but it could have been Jonathan Franzen. It was one of the Jonathans who I admire.
In Brooklyn.
And they're all novelists. They don't even have an option to be anything else if they're born with that name. that the people who become big readers fall into two categories, the ones who the parents came into the room and said, put that book away, and the ones who basically kept it for them always and sort of celebrated it. My mother is absolutely a role model because she never said to me, you can be a writer, but here, let's take the LSATs and see if that works out too, just in case. And I once gave a reading, and there was a Q&A afterward, and a woman said, my daughter wants to be a playwright, but I know she can't probably make a living out of this. What should I tell her? And my answer was really, you know, the world will probably whittle her down in the way that it does. A mother shouldn't. And my mother followed that.
And maybe she'll turn out to be a good playwright.
Maybe she will. And, you know, you worry about the other stuff later. If you want to write, you just do it.
Well, I'm sure you heard a lot of talk over the dinner table about that sort of thing, because you can't get it from just watching somebody, right? They go off to a room and they sit alone and say, please don't disturb me.
It never actually seemed romantic, because back, this was in the days of the Smith Corona. It was even pre-IBM, you know, this quivering machine that made noise. And I would leave for school in the morning. My mother would be in a bathrobe sitting at her Smith Corona. I'd come back at the end of the day. She'd still be there as though she hadn't moved, looking kind of unhappy.
But haven't you talked about liking to write in public? Are you still doing that, taking a laptop
to
cafes and write there?
As a New Yorker, you really kind of learn to turn down ambient noise to kind of – I like to write at home, but I write in libraries and I write in coffee shops, definitely, where I can. Nothing makes me happier than kind of leaving an environment and just sort of having a little – it's like a sorbet between courses, going somewhere else to write. I love it.
And you've also talked about the pace of writing. You used to write very slowly. Now, are you writing faster?
You know, there's something to be said for having to make a living as a writer. I think it's actually been really helpful to me. I mean, I don't have stuff to fall back on, you know, big family money to fall back on. I have book contracts and deadlines that I need to meet, so I take them very, very seriously. But it's hard to say, today I'm going to write prose that really, really soars. And some days you have a terrible day of prose, and then you get very, very worried. But I really, really try to – if I'm not writing, I'm thinking about writing. So if you see me walking around or sitting in that coffee shop just eating, I'm thinking.
Is it important to include all of the things that are happening in the world around you at the time, for example, Facebook?
It's not important to include Facebook in a novel. This novel does deal with technology as well as books and talks about the sort of – has intimacy changed because of that. But some novel – I mean, there's – I think at least two different kinds of novels. There's the shapely, small novel, and then there's the novel that's like the big pocketbook that includes everything the writer's thinking about at the time. Mm-hmm. And then there's something maybe in the middle, and this one I think is sort of in the middle. I tried to shape it because it does – because it has a production of a play going on, you know, you have an innate sense as a reader that you're going to get that play at the end of the book. But I did try to put in everything I was thinking about female desire – the internet, the straight, because the internet's a spell too. You know, I get an email and I go, oh, I wonder what it is, as though it's going to say, you've won the MacArthur Prize. What is it that we think? What's in it? What's the spell? What's the lure, the seduction that keeps us sometimes away from love and toward other things?
Away from anything. People the theater not willing to shut down their iPhones because they have to check out the latest email message that has come.
But I think we still don't understand what that compulsion is toward it. I don't know what it is. I still don't think I know why I too feel that way. I feel like I've been corrupted a bit. My brain has been obviously changed in neuron ways. There's a lot written about that. But just the sense that there's something better elsewhere. And when you're reading, and you know, the idea when you go to a book, this point has been made that you go for knowledge as opposed to information sometimes.
Well, maybe with good fiction, you gain some kind of insight.
Yeah, because if you're going to a Virginia Woolf novel, you know, for the one thing, you will not find it. You will not find it. And when you go to the theater, can't you do that thing that John Updike said about reviewing, which is submit to the spell of the story? And I think that the spell is the operative part for me.
Although I'm not wishing the spell in your novel on anybody.
No. I should say, not to give too much away, but it does lift at the end.
Meg Wolitzer's novels include The 10-Year Nap, The Position, The Wife, and now her latest, The Uncoupling, is published by Riverhead Books. Thank you for being with us again.
Oh, thank you.